got now. Hey, the red light is on.
Okay. Hello, I'm Jay Brandstetter, and I write for UC Strategies. Joining me are two of my colleagues, Michael Finneran and David Yedwab, both of whom write for UC Strategies as well. And we'll be talking today to Professor Henning Schildrini, who is Chair of Computer Science at, turns out, my alma mater, Columbia University. And the main topic of the discussion is SIP and its relation to unified communications. With that, welcome, Henning.
Thank you, and I should add, just so that I don't get in trouble for resume inflation, that I handed off my chair responsibilities a while ago, so I'm just the faculty.
Okay. One of the things which is on everybody's mind, it seems, who is in the unified communications area, is the role of SIP. To some, it's really the glue that holds everything in unified communications together. For example, a comment made very recently at Interop by a gentleman from Avaya, who stated that Avaya believes SIP will remain the driver of innovation in unified communications for the next decade, putting it on a par with TCP/IP as a network game changer. And that's echoed by many other things that are occurring in the industry with regards to the role of SIP as the primary glue, if you will, in unified communications. Care to comment on that?
So I believe that the statement itself has a great deal of truth to it, simply because kind of by a process of elimination, SIP has assumed the role of being the protocol that a large set of otherwise disconnected vendors and communities can agree on. And I think that's the role, generally speaking, of standards, in the sense that you can have arm's length relationship without having to constantly worry about what all the other parties in an ecosystem, if you like, happen to be doing at any given time. So I would see SIP as a core backstage component, but it is certainly not the only component that will drive unified communication. The traditional web protocols, for example, already have and will continue to have a major role to play.
Henning, this is Michael. I had a question, because one of the issues I see coming up around SIP regularly now are proprietary extensions, where the vendors will have a plain vanilla SIP, but then their own enhanced version, which will provide greater functionality if you stay all within their product lines. Do you see that as a useful add-on to SIP, or simply more of the same proprietary technology the vendors have been pawning off on us for however many years?
I admit that I'm usually very skeptical as to these proprietary extensions. There are several reasons for people doing that. One is that some vendors do it because they want something, quote, simple, that so another standards-based solution is available, but they want to use, to take a favorite example of mine, use a SIP info request for everything because they think that's just easier to program, and then essentially repackage what one could label laziness as a feature. Then there's a separate category of vendors, I think, that do that, that have genuine needs to support specialized functionality that just can't be handled in a standard. I think that's a typical situation at the edges for any still evolving technology. That happens in the web realm, that happens in other computing realms, and other APIs. And there I see kind of two or three ways to judge whether the vendor is really having the interest of the customer in mind or, let's say, primarily their own. So the first indication is as to whether they are actively pursuing standardizing that particular extension if it is generally useful. So if it's really extremely narrow, there's probably no need for it, but then interoperability probably isn't a major function. If it's really only needed to deal with one special device, not a big problem. But if it claims to be a true differentiator and true additional functionality, well, the general community would benefit from it, and it should, in the longer term, be standardized. And then we'll just have to deal with the transition that we have in the past, and again, that's true, I think, across most of networking, all the way from MPLS up to the application layer, had things that were in the early stages of standardization, yet already had relatively widespread deployment. So that's, to me, a good indication that the vendor is essentially serious about caring for interoperability and putting the interest of their customers first, as opposed to simply using that for differentiation.
Hang on. Let's stay on the. This is David. Let's stay on the interoperability issue for a moment. What does interoperability mean in the standards world? Given that SIP is really setting up the communication between endpoints, et cetera, and where do you think we need to have the vendors play better together in interoperability going forward?
So I would differentiate kind of two levels of interoperability. The first one is the very basic, can I place a call for two devices that haven't necessarily met in a lab before? And I think we're doing pretty well on that. Most of the problems that occur tend to be not SIP-related problems. They tend to be problems related to, say, codec issues, codec support, just simply because a variety of both technical and licensing and legal reasons, different people support different codecs, and so you may only get fairly basic commonality functionality. For example, wideband codecs are still problematic in that realm. And then there are more advanced functions, and in particular, where I see issues still are more advanced functions related to security, for example, supportive TLS, advanced functionality related to presence and event notification, and some of the more advanced SIP features are not universally deployed, such as call transfer in its various guises, or specific pad, early call, pre-call media, and so on. And so those are not necessarily functions which prevent a call from happening, but they are the kind of functions that lead to unpleasant surprises because one party does something and suddenly it doesn't do what you'd expect if the other side has a different device in that. And those are where I think particularly certain large vendors have not always been as speedy, but catching up with what everybody agrees should be implemented.
Can you give us an example of one of those?
I'm not sure I want to name names, but they are certainly a vendor that often has their equipment shown in movies.
Okay.
Very diplomatic.
Yes, we know who that is. Turning a little bit to, and this is really for Michael and Henning, where is SIP, or where could SIP be with regards to the world of wireless and things like fixed mobile convergence?
Well, frankly, we're dying for it.
Yes. Go ahead, please.
Our biggest obstacle has been the reluctance of the mobile carriers. Of course, when you look at it, the wireless networks for the most part today, certainly through 2G, are the last bastion of circuit switching. We're still knocking up a pipe between a pair of subscribers for the duration of the call. They haven't made the move to IP, much less the move to SIP. Certainly going forward, what we would look for, my phrase is a direct intelligent interface between the enterprise and the mobile operator. A direct connection so we can be passing calls directly back and forth between the two. But certainly the intelligent part would be based on SIP. So we could, as Henning mentioned, not just make and receive calls, but make those voice calls, video calls, and texts. But the real beauty of SIP, and particularly with Simple, the IM and presence level extensions, would be to allow us to expose the present status of the mobile device, maybe its battery status as well, because those are a critical issue, and most importantly in mobility is location. It's when we can start dealing with the mobile devices in that intelligent fashion and tying that information into calendars and presence and all of the other integrated functions we have in the UC environment, that's where I really see the leap forward in terms of functionality. As it stands today, we can do a pretty decent job of UC in a wired environment, but that all falls apart when we walk out the door. And I think the key will be that direct intelligent interface and the intelligence driven by SIP, but it's really going to be a matter of the mobile operator signing on to that, and that could be a long-term development. Henning, what did you think?
Yes, and I think I would like to just add one facet to that. I mean, to put it somewhat crudely, is I would like to basically either say kind of get with it or get out of the way. And let me explain what I mean by these two options. The get with it option is that you indeed have the carrier itself support IP-based, SIP-based signaling all the way to the end system and make it openly available in the sense that SIP messages can be sent not just within the walled garden of a particular carrier, but between carriers and between enterprise and carrier. And like you mentioned, that simple messages, including location, can be retrieved and that devices can register not just with the carrier, but with other providers as well. And the get out of the way option is essentially an unbundling. So that if you provide IP all the way to the end system, and I'm talking here not just about my web-capable IP, but the media-capable bearer type of capabilities, then the carrier really wouldn't even have to do its own call signaling. There's really no particular reason why the SIP proxy has to be in the carrier network, wireless carrier network. A third party or an enterprise could do that just the same, just as long as the device that's on the mobile device has the ability to receive IP packets without going through all kinds of contortions so that it can be indeed notified when a call comes in. And so in some ways, I would actually, at least as an option, have the second alternative, because generally speaking, that would foster innovation and competition, because then you can choose the provider of call services independent from the provider of bearer and transport services, and then you get innovation such as we've seen to some extent, like for example, in Skype and Google Voice, which have probably provided more new functionalities than traditional carriers have in many years.
Yeah. Unfortunately, with the mobile operators, I'm afraid we're going to have to drag them toward that kicking and screaming. It's interesting you mentioned Google, because I'm seeing a considerable amount of pressure being brought against the mobile operators currently from both internal and from external sources. Internally, as the carriers move to 4G, one of the core principles of 4G is not just a higher capacity radio link, the OFDM MIMO link that's part and parcel with LTE, but it's also, for the first time, a mobile network that's built on an all-IP core. They are transitioning, belatedly, from the circuit switch environment to the packet switch environment, so there'll be that internal pressure to move in the internet direction. But you mentioned the big name there, which is the Google factor in this, because Google has been quite strategic in making both investments and using their lobbying capital to start bringing about change in the mobile industry. Google was key in getting the FCC to require the all bidders in the C block and the 700 megahertz auctions that went off last summer, the auction 73, to support open devices. At the same time, there's been a big push behind the TV white space, space initiatives, and at least a minor investor in Clearwire. So they seem to be pushing the open agenda in the wireless space. At the same time that they have the Android operating system, new distribution model for their Nexus One mobile phones. Google, in a number of what seem to be at face value unrelated initiatives, really does seem to be moving to put real pressure on the mobile operators to start acting like everything else we've been doing in the internet.
Yeah, and so I think this is not too surprising. Clearly it's in the new, in Google's enlightened self-interest to do that, and it is, to some extent, it's a cultural thing. When they're used to operating in an environment where services are unbundled from transport, where services are, relatively speaking, independent of each other. In a sense, you can use Google Search and not use Gmail and use Google Voice and never touch any other Google service, and generally where most services have at least some APIs that allow external access to those services. And those are things that, relatively speaking, seem somewhat foreign to most more traditional carriers.
Yeah.
Just culturally speaking.
Yeah, but we are doing a pretty good job of working around them. Now that we've got more readily available, higher capacity 3G data services, even if the carrier doesn't want to provide a location-based service, the location is stored in the handset. We can simply send a mobile data message that reports where the device is. And a lot of applications, everything from Flickster to Urban Spoon, can now take advantage of the location capability. But all this seems to be happening around the mobile operator rather than in conjunction with the mobile operator.
Interesting.
Indeed.
It's also absent the enterprise to a large degree, and maybe I'd like to turn the conversation in that direction, and the relationship of SIP and unified communications within the enterprise. Would you care to comment on that? I mean, do you see more than just voice being a major role with SIP and the focus on communications enabling business processes as we're trying to evolve the unified communications direction to? Would you care to comment on any of that, Henning?
Yeah, and I see that as really a possibility to do things that we haven't been able to do. Particularly, I'm really hopeful of the ability to leverage location information and not just plain longitude and latitude, but enhance location information for business processes in a way that makes it easy to build vertical applications that are tailored to the specific business. So not just a generic kind of voicemail, instant messaging, presence type of application, but something which can easily be customized to the specific needs of a plumber or a delivery service or a legal service or a medical practice or any of these very different small businesses and obviously also larger businesses with large workforces. And the goal, and I think we don't have that quite realized, is to make it easy for a programmer to develop applications that integrate with not just in a single inbox or in a single display for a user, single web page, but actually integrate with corporate processes. Because that's where I think the real value is, not just kind of the ability for a single user to track all communication through a single address or a single pretty web page, but tying into the internal databases with information, into customer relationships, into process workflow systems, into ERP system, et cetera.
Yeah. How does
SIP play in that, in moving what we might want to call as a front office communications application into the back office business processes?
The role I see is because it is an open standard, and because there are libraries available for just about every platform, and there are server platforms available that integrate with established web-style platforms like Tomcat and others, that it makes it relatively straightforward if you can indeed get the SIP level information into those systems to then leverage existing, say, Java-based enterprise systems without having a completely separate architecture just for the presence or the location part or the call routing part. And without having to rely on specific APIs indirectly, because you get direct access to the full functionality as opposed to kind of the indirect model, which we've practiced in the PBX world for a while, where you kind of get to poke the PBX and ask it a few questions and maybe get some limited window into what's happening, but you never have full control over the call flow or the data that's sent or who the data is being forwarded to and who's being made visible to and events occurring and all of these other things that tend to be difficult in a classical API call model that you might have in a more a higher level interface that you might get on a PBX.
Can you go?
The word PBX has been getting some interesting attention lately with regards to alternatives, which, for lack of a better term, I'll call software-based methods for handling voice. Doesn't mean, quote-unquote, the PBX is dead per se, but it certainly may be breathing with some difficulty. How do you see that going forward?
So, I do see still a role for a PBX simply because it allows certain core communication functionality to be easily packaged and be installed readily and support kind of a 99% of basic, I can call the office functionality, which continues to be an important piece of functionality that people want to rely on. What I see it really as is as an adjunct. So just like we now have, if you look at, say, for example, email, we have a pretty standard set of email servers and even email appliances that people use for their corporate communication. But generally speaking, for at least companies that rely on email for more than just kind of casual, informal, unstructured communication, there are now tools and mechanisms in place so that email can be processed, handled, and integrated with other pieces of the corporate IT environment. It's not a standalone box where you just have wires going in and out and as best maybe a web management interface. And I see the same role that instead of a PBX trying to do everything is that the PBX can essentially provide a core functionality and provide some kind of the things that most everybody needs, so you don't have to reinvent that, particularly for small to mid-sized enterprises where that's just not a viable proposition, and then make it easy to directly intercept and work with the signaling functionality and possibly in some cases also just a higher level control APIs to provide per enterprise customized functions and extensions. So I think a PBX, if done right, can do that simply because it's a reasonably constrained environment. If it's designed well, it works out of a box. It has a relatively low maintenance cost and can be designed for high reliability. And so it can provide somewhat of a kind of a solid foundation particularly for companies that don't want to delve deeply into technology.
When we talked last year, we touched briefly on SIP trunking. SIP trunking has gone bananas in the last number of months. Is there any reason to assume that's not going to continue?
Yeah, I mean, I see that actually as a very useful service offering that allows essentially a combination of splitting functionality that is most readily provided by an external service provider, namely the PSTN interface and the interface to the rest of the existing telephony world, both mobile and landline, voice of IP, and traditional, and to then having the ability to host services locally, again, on a local PBX or something, which may not exactly look like one, but provide some of the same call routing and data storage and privacy and directory functions that you need. And so I see that as a extremely promising kind of common service interface, just like it used to be that when you wanted, a mid-sized company wanted telephony services, they knew, oh, yeah, just ask for a T1 and plug it in, and I can get, I know what I'm getting, and I can have somebody else deal with the stuff that I'm really not good at or can't really deal with, namely the wide area part.
Is there anything in the standards arena, I guess the IETF in particular, where unified communication is sort of changing things or being examined with regards to SIP extensions for UC?
Not specifically. I think traditionally the IETF has taken more or less a component-based approach, and UC was never kind of something new. It was always just assumed that everything would be unified on IP. So that was kind of, in a sense, why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you have a unified whatever? So from that perspective, I think longer-term IETF participants would see that as a, as in, man, why wouldn't you do that? And we shouldn't have to do anything special for that. I do see some efforts which are not directly UC related in its immediate core, some of the efforts to standardize services as a way to address interoperability. That seems to be a potentially promising effort that can help unified communication, but it's not, I don't see that as a major driver in and of itself right now.
When we talked last time, Henning, we chatted a little bit about UC as related to university curriculum, such as Columbia and other places. And my takeaway was that at this point in time, very little is being done at the undergraduate or even graduate level in presenting UC to the computer science or engineering student. Is that changing, or if it's not, what do you think is necessary to quote-unquote legitimize UC to make it more acceptable to the world of academia?
So that's, you raise a very interesting question, which I think is it's a challenge that academic departments, particularly large research universities, have always faced, and UC is really just one specific example of that, namely the tension between talking about relatively special technologies in the global scheme of things and the need to address more generic knowledge and issues. And so the practical reality for a department, even a somewhat larger department, is that when we have about 120 PhD students that are divided among about 35, 36 faculty, researching a huge variety of areas from very theoretical computer science to graphics to robotics to compilers and software engineering and any number of other areas, computer engineering, et cetera. And so communication plays a role, but is we only have in the department, and we are probably better equipped, so to say, than most departments, I'd say about 3 faculty that deal with communication at all among the 30 or so, 35 faculty at Columbia. And that's probably not atypical in the sense that you would have probably less than 10% of a typical faculty on a computer science or electrical engineering department would be communication related. And most of those faculty will work in areas that are more considered more of a research heavy areas of communication networking. Protocol design, lower level networks, routing, transport protocols, performance, a few other areas, social network areas from an analytical perspective, et cetera. So that has made it difficult, even for the much broader area, if we even leave UC aside for a moment, for a broader area such as what you might call advanced communication applications, to find a large foothold. So, for example, there's really only one academically-oriented conference each year, IPTCOM, that specifically addresses what I would consider the core multimedia communication space in the interactive space. There are other conferences that are more in the multimedia space or in the IMS space, for example. But if you look at kind of a more generic conference in that area, there's probably only one, maybe two conferences a year that are more academically focused. And so that tends to drive faculty hiring and faculty activity. So that doesn't prevent university departments offering specialized graduate courses doing that, but the practical reality is that if you look at master's students, they can take 10 courses, roughly speaking, for their master's program, of which 5 are core courses, 5 are electives, and so you pretty quickly find out that the amount of specialization that you can even do at a master's program is limited. Because you want to, beyond the core, in somebody in networking-related areas that needs to take a security course, you want to probably offer a more advanced performance course. And so the ability to integrate a particular sub-area into a pretty broad curriculum is somewhat limited. Now, I believe there are opportunities at some more specialized institutions that tend to be a bit more, I would say, industry-oriented as opposed to research-oriented. So I'll name, as a good example of an institution which I think is succeeding in that, the Illinois Institute of Technology in Wheaton, Illinois, where there's a faculty is offering a range of more, what I would say, practically oriented, not just UC, but practically oriented voice and multimedia communication courses and activities. That's just not quite as viable for a more traditional research university.
Interesting. My observations recently is that more and more UC is at the main of the business school as opposed to the engineering school. Because if you think about it, it's a set of tools. Yes, they're communications tools, but the end result of these tools is helping the business processes of the enterprise. Mm. And that's a business imperative as opposed to straight engineering.
It sounds more like an outgrowth of operations management than it is, as Henning is putting it, as a pure research topic.
Right.
Yeah. And so one area where I actually think there is an opportunity there that I think has not been leveraged as much beyond the ones that you mentioned is what's happening now is that the broader area of information, what is outside academia called information technology, is really being split into two major areas, or if you'd like, 3 of them. Namely, the 3 areas would be computer engineering, which deals more with hardware and hardware design, computer science, which is clearly the broader area, information science, the third area. So there is now what are now known as the iSchools in our business, so to say, which are information science schools, and they tend to focus more, grossly simplifying, but their mission tends to be more the application of technology and its impact on business and society and other interesting entities. And so they are the ones that, for example, in pre-unified communication days might have looked at the impact of enterprise data systems on enterprise efficiency, how to best organize these systems, how to best utilize and progress these systems. They do a lot of analysis on those, but they're not necessarily the ones developing algorithms and protocols. And so I would imagine that there seems to be a, I don't know why that is, currently a lack of investment in that area. It's probably, as usual, a people problem. Namely, if there were more people at these information sciences schools that had an interest or background in those areas, they would be the ones to build programs, and they can probably, even within their research activities, do a very nice job looking at, for example, the interaction of users with unified communication system, which really, in my mind, is an area which has not received the attention that it deserves.
Interesting. David or Michael, do you have any additional questions?
I had one relating to the migration or the potential migration of voice communications, unified communications to the cloud, and the role that SIP might play in that potential migration, and what sort of a time frame do you see cloud really manifesting itself as a changed way of communicating?
So let me see if I'm not quite sure I understood your question completely, but let me see, and you'll stop me if I'm veering off into the weeds here. So if you look at cloud type of computing in general, there is a good match between the kind of capabilities that SIP offers and its structure and the ability to do that in a cloud type of setting. So just as a kind of a bit of advertisement, we are actually right now pursuing a small research project in that general direction. The big advantage there is, like with all these type of applications, the ease of scalability to very quickly and efficiently deploy services over very large scales, scale ranges from a few users to millions of users, without fundamentally re-architecting the system. So that was always my hope for, before really the word and the architecture were really there, that that would become a more common mode of operation as opposed to just the locally hosted infrastructure that's isolated, kind of the PBX replacement model. And so I do see real opportunities, in particular because, again, that I can't claim great foresight there, just kind of a nice coincidence that the model that you have separates nicely the stateful data storage, primarily subscriber record and presence record storage, from the largely stateless processing model, which is essentially an ideal model for deploying such system in a cloud-type environment. So I'm not quite sure if that addresses your question, so maybe you can try to...
That got to it very well.
Okay.
Do you see any... I keep likening cloud to, in a sense, a back to the future almost, to the mainframe kind of environment, if you will, with services being provided remotely rather than in our local device. Do you see that kind of transformation happening in this move towards data centers for everything and for the cloud, if you will, or am I off on another tree?
No, I think there's the two facets that I see as kind of the cloud allowing to do is the first one, taking a mission critical, to use that cliche, component and put it in a place where it's easier to provide reliability, and in an environment where the notion of a single site kind of representing, say, for example, all employees makes less and less sense. And it just isn't, in many places, an easily identifiable headquarters building where you should place the server or the PBX for a whole large company, so that it is in a data center operated by somebody else, really, geographically speaking, may even be closer to the average user of that system than would be a more traditional data center, a locally hosted data center environment. And so from a reliability perspective, I think that makes obvious sense. It's just a lot easier to have somebody else worry about electricity failover and generators and having to do that at a small to mid-sized company. The second one is the scaling aspect. And there, just like now, many companies have started to use outsourced email services simply because they have found that the functionality is common enough that there isn't that much differentiation capability, and it's a pain enough to administer that you might as well somebody else have to take care of it and do it at scale. I'm primarily talking not so much at server scale, but simply having it being done at for specialized software monitoring, specialized staff, and so on. And this is what's happening in many universities, for example, that are now taking some of their classical applications, including email, and outsourcing them to, say, Google through their Google Apps Tab program. And that, I think, is something where which makes obvious sense for unified communication as well. The setup costs tend to be large if you do that for an individual small to mid-sized company, relatively speaking. It is requires somewhat specialized knowledge, which most run-of-the-mill system administrators don't have. And usually, for all but the largest company, the kind of solutions you get are really vastly oversized. You really don't need a whole server by itself, or even the usual half rack full of servers for the different components just for 100 people. And so from a cost effectiveness perspective, I believe that makes a large amount of sense. The scaling also works in the other way, in the sense that it's just a whole lot easier in that environment, if necessary, to scale up without having to suddenly say, oh, well, we thought we only needed 100 lines in our system, and now we merged with another company, and now we suddenly need 500, so we need to tear up the whole system and just buy a completely new one with all the changes that brings. So I do see a large role, not an exclusive, but a very large role in that environment, simply because the separation that is designed into, in particular, SIP, of media communication, which should go end-to-end, and signaling, which doesn't really have to, is almost ideal for a cloud type of setting, since latency and other issues just are not a concern in that environment, since the media, generally speaking, at least doesn't have to traverse some faraway server in a data center that you don't own.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
Yes. Thank you.
I had one question coming in, but as it turns out, Henning answered it along the way. I've always been fascinated with how our technology developed, and since SIP is so key to UC today, I was wondering if things like unified communications, because as far as I know, we didn't have the term back when SIP was born, and as Henning was there in the at the birth of this, whether things like UC were considered as that this is where this is where SIP will be taking our communications. And your frank answer along the way was unified. Why would you do it any other way? So I'm glad to see that this was envisioned early on in the plan.
Yeah, and so that it always seemed like if the mantra always was, from the very beginning of the internet, that everything over IP and so that was kind of a unifying vision in two senses of a word. And so it was fairly natural. I mean, if you look at the very beginnings of, if you look at SIP just as a very kind of a small piece of it, if you look at the addressing modality, the very first addressing modality that we designed into SIP weren't telephone numbers, they were email addresses. And indeed, if you look at kind of the very first SIP system that a student and I built before it was even a standard, we assumed that your communication address would be your email address, because that's something that everybody that we cared about at the time, at least, already had. So this was in the kind of mid-90s, and so that was, in a sense, I would say, if anything in the evolution, somewhat backtracked, where we kind of got stuck on the PSTN replacement aspect of the whole thing, and didn't worry so much of unifying and playing nice with other means of communication. And really, just in the last few years, we discovered that that's an opportunity that we can leverage now that we have accomplished some of the other transitions along the way, from analog and digital to packet switched.
Well, great. Well, heading up, that's a good way to conclude this podcast. And I want to thank you on behalf of Michael and David and our listeners to the podcast on UC Strategies for your participation. It was a pleasure, and we added much to what we discussed last year. Thank you, Michael and David. And
thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. It was our pleasure as well.
Yes, always enlightening.
Thanks again.
Okay.
You can turn off the recorder now.